This episode is sponsored in part by Swim. Okay, here's a depressing stat. 70% of shoppers who want your products never actually buy them. They browse, they consider, then they forget. That's revenue walking out the door. Swim Wishlist Plus turns browsers into buyers. Customers save products they want, get notified when prices drop or items restock. You can also engage them in personalized fashion through your marketing or sales outreach. It's like having a personal shopper reminding them to come back and buy from you instead of your competitors. And 45,000 stores already use it, and it only takes 5 minutes to install. You could try it free today for 14 days. Go to getswim.com/Kurt. That's swimwithay.com/Kurt. Turn those maybe laters into sales today. Getswim.com. Today on the show, we're going to hear from Nehal Kazim from AdPros, who I think is just a very honest, candid, and excellent marketer. I heard him speak at Smart Marketer Live in Denver this year. I really enjoyed what he had to say. He had, you know, a lot of great advice. And then when we were talking after the fact on it, also, you know, I was really, really impressed by his approach and his candor. And I think, you know, so much B2B content out there, especially, you know, marketer-wise, is when it's successful, it's often superficial. And like that's, we were just discussing, that is a fine line for us to walk. And so we're going to pick his brain on what's working with Meta Ads and Dramata performance marketing. But really, the thing we should know about are some of his claims. He, AdPros, says that they drive unreasonable growth. And he's built this very, you know, I think, narrow focus on adding $1 million to a business. Okay, that's interesting. It's tough to make claims like that. You got to really know what you're doing. So let's dive into it. Nehal, thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
Doing great, man. Thanks for having me on.
So, all right, on your site, on AdPros, you say that you seek unreasonable growth. What do we mean by that? Define it.
Unreasonable growth comes down to the size of a company. At a smaller revenue amount, unreasonable may be growing 10% month on month. For a $100 million company, that might be 20% annually, you know? So it just depends of like the size of that business and what level of profitability they want to do it at. When companies are smaller, it's very easy to double very quickly. But at different stages of a company, that same number, just numbers get bigger, it's way harder to add new customers, and the percentages fundamentally decrease. And so for us, when we come into a brand, the goal is usually 5 to 10% month-on-month growth for companies that are already doing $1 million to $5 million a month on average. And so that's our starting point.
$1 million to $5 million a month.
A month. And our responsibility and the goal that I'm coming in with is that how do we add your next $1 million a month? And so at $1 million a month, to go to $2 million a month, you have to double your company. It's very significant. But we've been in situations where they're already doing $10 million a month or $16 million in some cases. And our next million a month is still very hard. It's just a lower percentage of their total revenue.
It's a wonderful promise. How? Right? Like what is...
It's very hard.
I imagine.
Yeah.
So, you know, typically marketing agencies, you know, are focus on, especially like with claims like that, they're like, well, it's omni-channel. You know, they're really trying to plug in an entire new channel to a business, which on the marketer's end, maybe that's easy. You know, on the actual fulfillment and operations for the brand, much harder.
Very hard.
You have constrained yourself where, you know, you look for this very like focused, efficient execution. Talk to me about that approach.
It's come from a lot of pain and struggle of inefficient, unproductive execution over and over again. And the reason, you know, when I've been running my company for 13 years or so, when I first started, I didn't have a goal of how much revenue can we add to a business because I didn't do it before. I didn't have confidence. With volume, with repetition, we started making claims of we can add $100,000 a month to your coaching business, to your info product business, because we accomplished that a few times. And so as we've got more experience and more results, the goal is like, how can we actually add $1 million a month to your business? Ideally of net net new business, new customer revenue. And the way that we normally do that, you know, when you're saying of like adding a new channel, you can do that. And we've done that where we spent $2 million a month on a new channel on native ads, and we're able to add a lot of revenue, but it's very hard to crack a new channel. And we've also failed at it a lot. And so usually when we're adding the significant amount of revenue, it's with existing channels, and then channel expansion happens after, depending on how we're involved.
Which, yeah, I think that approach makes more sense. In your, you've been doing this 13 years. At what point did it occur to you that you have a repeatable system?
I think it started when we were introduced to an e-commerce company, the first time we were ever introduced to an e-commerce company. And they said, we have to spend $60,000 a month in advertising. Like, we need you to figure it out for us, or we cannot work together. And I've never been in that situation, because most people are like, here's $10,000 a month or $30,000 a month that we were managing primarily. Like, make it better. Like, okay. But these guys were different because they had a supplement company. They had to get net new customers and increase the velocity of the growth of their business, or they are going to die based off of churn. Like, there's only so much LTV. And so they had a new customer acquisition problem, and we were able to fix that. But once we fixed it, we realized that this is a completely different game from info products or coaching at that time, because there's so much limitation in terms of market demand, or based off the market, the offers that we were working on, or a client delivery, which is a massive challenge in the coaching business. And so that first time something clicked. And then as we did multiple lower ticket, high volume, mass market opportunities, we're like, whoa, this is real. And I think where it really clicked is when we first started tracking of like, wait, how far are we from managing $1 million a month? And that became a goal. And that's where it became like more of a game. Because before that, I was just trying to figure it out.
And tell me about achieving profitability with this. Like, certainly I could come up with ways to spend ads and lose money doing it, right? That's always the fear, but you want to do it profitably. Tell me about that approach or your thoughts there.
Yes. So this is very important, because everyone talks about growth, but no one talks about profitability, or there's all this like shame, guilt, fear around profit. And it's not cool, because like not everyone has the financing or the means or the stomach to do that. And so one of the consulting clients I just got off a call with yesterday, she's like, we went and added over $100,000 a month of new customers, but I didn't have the money. I had to get a loan, because most of our revenue was new customer, and we didn't have a cap of how many new customers we can actually afford. And so there was no measure to decide of how much new customers should we get, because there needs to be a balance. And so we have clients right now that we operate based off of what is the business-wide profitability, what is the max number of new customers you can get in your business based off of current new customer ROAS or contribution margin. And then we try to max that out. As the business has more recurring revenue for a subscription business, for example, we have the ability to acquire more customers. That's one side of it. The other side is people are saying, we've had this situation, their monthly burn was like $50,000 a month. Their revenue was $40,000 a month. They have COGS and advertising, which was another $30,000 a month just on advertising. And so they're losing money. The way that we went about it is we set benchmarks of what is the business-wide profitability we want, what is the new customer profitability we want. And as subscription revenue added up, we were able to increase our business-wide profitability targets, because it was like 100% at the initial. We spend $40,000, we make $40,000. But in order to create that subscription business work, we need to get new customers, get them to stick. And then we went from 100% ROAS to 120, 140, all the way up to like 250 over time. And then they can decide how profitable they want to be. That's when it gets fun. But whenever we make any kind of claim, the whole point is we will not and cannot spend if we're not at this level of profitability on new customer acquisition specifically, and ideally business-wide profitability.
Well, I was talking to a client yesterday who really had seen incredible growth after, you know, in the last year, after, you know, we rebuilt their website. And then they hired, you know, new marketing company, and they're running meta ads to this thing. And the traffic doubled, conversion rate went up 4x. Like, they're really, really doing well selling a consumable good, you know, like supplement, beauty, that type of space, skincare. And the issue they then said is like, okay, now how do we move to retention? How do we keep these customers? And like, they'd done everything right, loyalty program and using Rebuy or Recharge for subscriptions and email marketing automation. And we're still struggling to convert customers to second, third, fourth purchases. A lot of what you mentioned now sounded like new customer acquisition, top of funnel. Are there approaches, levers to pull, strategies for someone in this position where it's like, hey, we're getting these customers, we just need them to buy again?
I think the acquisition strategy comes from retention. So most people do it the other way around, which is, what is the highest ROAS I can get with this messaging, with this offer, with this bundle, with this funnel? I think that's backwards, because what usually happens is that that person doesn't reorder. And so what we look at is, where is the lifetime gross profit coming from? Not lifetime revenue, because different products have different COGS and different cost structures that don't tell the full story. And so we had a client that had 62% COGS, for example, around that range. And so that lifetime revenue is not meaningful, because we have to decide of like, what is the true lifetime revenue and what is the gross profit from those orders over 3 years, for example? And then how much is that worth? And then how do we connect that to acquisition? And so if you're, especially for more established businesses, they have an advantage where they can analyze and understand who is that high value, high LTV customer, and lifetime gross profit customer, and then work backwards to, what is the offer, messaging, landing pages, even ad channel that we can acquire that high quality customer for? And now the mechanics change, because you're not just optimizing for day one ROAS in a subscription company environment. You're looking at, what is my lifetime gross profit, and then reversing it back into it.
Based on the depth of that answer, after this call, I'm going to pitch you on introducing you to this particular client. I'm thinking you may be able to solve some issues for them. So I'm excited to have solved that problem potentially for a client.
Yeah, and one of the things that what we've done analysis on is, we use a platform to connect customer Shopify data to like census data, as well as like overall demographic data of the U.S. population from a...
Oh my gosh, how?
Quantitative standpoint, we use a platform called Faraday. And so we connect that, and then we define personas based off of data instead of just our perception, right?
Like, instead of vibes, which is how like pretty much everybody does it.
Exactly. And I got frustrated at one point of like, we're just guessing. And so we need to figure out like, who are these people? And it's not perfect, but it's way more accurate. And we got exposed because we were doing this free plus shipping funnel. And we found out that the people who are actually buying this free plus shipping funnel, the way it was structured and messaging and offer, they were incredibly financially broke, and they didn't have money. And we are optimizing for a high average order value, high LTV dog business. And it was attracting the wrong person. And we could see our new customer CPAs and ROAS and all that kind of stuff. The mechanics are okay, but people weren't ordering. And then we found out, because of how we were doing advertising, we're simply marketing to the wrong person. And so those are very eye-opening elements. And with the same data, what we're able to do is look at, who is the highest LTV cohort, and is that different than the general makeup of the customer base based off of data? And so now we can see household in age, demographic, like gender, where they're located, household income and home worth, things like that, that we can connect to then take that over to additional persona and copy messaging, et cetera.
That's really clever, like being able to get that quantifiable data. What's that tool?
Faraday.
Okay. I think I've heard of it. I got to check that out. I've heard you talk about the 10 levers framework, and that you limit yourself to 3 levers. For me, as a Shopify online store expert, that's where we spend all our time. For me, the 3 levers, maybe a little broad, are store sessions, conversion rate, and average order value.
Right.
Ultimately, it's a formula, and I'm tweaking one of those 3 to improve revenue. What do the levers mean to you? What are your levers?
That is the best part of what we do. We choose our adventure based off of the client. And so the purpose of the 10 levers that I've outlined is that, here are the options based off of the strategic objectives this client has at this stage of the company. What are the right levers to pull right now? And so for a company like we've worked with Canada Goose, it, for our involvement, it was specifically, we need to optimize France from an advertising standpoint. In the context of Canada Goose, at a $1 billion in revenue and all the different things we can optimize, the levers would be so radically different compared to France. And so within France, we did a series of things of like changing our account structure on Meta. That was a major like lever. Meta was like the major opportunity. There wasn't that much that we were doing on the Google side, but there were specific promotions that helped. There were like catalogs and product launches that was a major opportunity. And then there was also like who we're marketing to was an opportunity from a persona standpoint. And so those levers are very different to when we got a challenge to add $1 million a month of new revenue as quickly as possible to a business who's already doing $4 million a month of net new customers already. And so that those levers are very different. And so it's very dependent. At the end of the day, the responsibility is based off of what you're working on right now or what your purview is. As a growth marketer, if it's across everything or individual channels, you get to decide of what levers to focus on at the cycle.
Here's a word from our sponsor, Zipify. December's not over, and neither are your sales opportunities. You just survived Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but are you maximizing every order that's still coming in? One-click upsell automatically increases average order value by up to 30%. With AI-powered upsells across your entire customer journey. Holiday shoppers are still buying. Gift cards, last-minute orders, New Year prep. Make every sale count. Launch pre-purchase and post-purchase upsells for every product in one click. Customers see personalized offers and spend more automatically. Unlike other apps, you only pay for results, not views. Takes under 2 minutes to set up, starts working immediately. Don't let December revenue slip away. Go to Zipify.com/Kurt for your 30-day free trial. That's Zipify.com/KURT. Finish the year strong, my friend. It would seem to me that the most obvious lever, and I'm not a Meta ads expert, is just spend more money, just more Zuck bucks. Is obviously, you know, that it can't be as simple as that. But, you know, what's the answer there? You know, how often is it as easy as just like, hey, throw more money at it?
Some of the people that the conference that we met at, the conversation was, why are we not spending more money? And for some people, it was because the last time we spent money, it broke. And so I don't want to risk it again. And so that's a conversation that I'm currently having with someone. But in terms of just spending more money, that is directly only applicable for people who are already successful in the platform. And the question becomes, what is your definition of success? And is it based off of business-wide or new customers? We look at new customer success primarily. In business-wide, there's a lot more factors. And so if you're successful, yes, you can increase your budget, and there's like multiple ways to do that. Usually, as soon as you do, or there's a breaking point of when you increase it 50% or 100%, something's going to break because you're not creating enough creatives, or you're not testing enough, or your account structure was not correct as it is, or your messaging and avatar is too narrow. And it doesn't allow, if you're spending $100,000 a month and you go to $500,000 a month, but all your messaging avatar and offer is for people who are very, very aware of the solution and not problem level from like five stages of awareness, it will break. It's not because your ads suck or your company isn't good or your product doesn't work. It's that the messaging doesn't align because now you have to educate at a different level to people at a higher step level of the funnel. And so that's why I don't think there are situations that, yes, you can increase your budget. I wish it was that easy. You must move to the next lever that's right for the problem of your business at that time. And usually in ads, it's account structure, creatives, copy, funnel.
One thing I've never understood, you know, revealing my ignorance here, is with Meta ads, when people talk about your creative and targeting, all that makes sense to me. When they talk about ad structure and seemingly how important it is, that baffles me. Like, wait, how it's arranged in the Facebook Business Manager?
It's really simple, actually. It's because Meta is an algorithm, right? It optimizes based off of an auction system. And the goal here is that you want to provide the highest quality signal and data to Meta in order for it to optimize and get what you want. And so if your data is segmented or incomplete or structured in a way that you're actually getting fragments throughout to train the algorithm, your pixel, to optimize for the right customer, it's just you're not doing yourself the favor. And so it's a very important question that you're asking. And I think a lot of brands owners especially don't ask this question. I was very anti ad consolidation except until I started seeing things work. And so we've had accounts we're spending $10,000, $20,000 a day or more on one campaign. And so that is because that one campaign, based off of the data that Meta wants to see, is getting the highest quality data. We're able to have a lot of stability in that structure. Meta is able to optimize and learn based off of that, and we're getting the results we want. And so the right structure does change a lot.
It sounds like what Meta wants now is consolidation.
You know, it's a big part of it.
Fewer campaigns.
Yeah, they've been pushing that for years. The issue has been is that once media buyers actually followed a lot of the consolidation advice, it didn't work. And so that's where people start hating their Meta reps, because they're like, well, Meta reps have a quota of how many people use a new feature and function from an adoption rate standpoint, but media buyers care about performance. And so now you have conflicting goals, as well as, you know, what the intentions are behind recommendations. And so it's very tricky, but now they're catching up, you know.
Do you like your Meta rep? How much weight should I put in what my Meta rep says?
I think the quality of reps that we have right now across multiple clients is like the highest it's ever been, because I think generally advertising like platforms are serving advertisers way more than they did like 5-7 years ago. They respect advertisers generally more based off of their actions. I don't value the words of a rep or an ad platform more than I value their actions. The quality of recommendations, the quality of support across a lot of bigger clients, because they spend more, or they have like a cachet, you know, in terms of how much revenue they do, they get more quality support, that's for sure. But the implementation is, from my perspective, it has been increasing over the years, instead of like kind of decaying, or, you know, there's been years that people are very frustrated with Meta of like lack of support or lack of transparency or making a series of changes. And so mostly just depends on who you follow on X. But
good point, for sure. With respect to ads, a phrase I heard over and over at this conference we're at, Smart Marketer, was creative diversity. What do we mean by creative diversity? Why did this become a buzzword in relation to Meta ads this year?
It's because Meta started it. So Meta wants creative diversity, and they're penalizing creative similarity. That's the important takeaway. So what is creative similarity? Meta has not been very clear on their communication. We have reps, you know, that we've got data from, but it's been inconsistent and not like very operational of what is creative similarity exactly. So creative diversity has started because of Andromeda. Andromeda came out earlier in the year, but, you know, at the time of this recording in terms of November, people really started feeling it in August and September of performance, whether that was Andromeda or not, that's TBD. But, you know, the actual narrative started with Meta. And so I can explain more from my perspective of what I think creative diversity is.
Please do.
Yeah. So my perspective is that from a creative, there are a series of variables. The variables are, what is the copy in the ad outside of the actual image, right? Then inside of image or video or carousel or any of the ad formats, what is the content inside of the creative as well in terms of visuals, as well as the copy, as well as the script? And so I like to separate it by variables, just so I can understand like what are we actually like talking about. So I've broken down for my team, and how we're looking at it is based off of three different elements of creative similarity. One is, what is the creative type? And so, is this an ad from a like video sales letter? That is a different creative type than like a Get Ready With Me video, or an ASMR video, or, you know, UGC, like day in the life video. Like all of these are different styles. And so that is one component of what is the creative type. Then it is the ad type. How does that, you know, the post-it note ad, for example, that type of creative, that ad type can appear in an image, it can appear in a video, it can appear in a carousel. So now you can combine creative type with your ad type. And then the last component from my perspective is messaging. Messaging is based off of what is the script inside of your video, for example, or the messaging you're using in your image. in terms of what the ad actually says. And as an example of what is inside of that post-it note. Is that inside of that post-it note a pain point? Is it a solution? Is it a benefit? Like, what are you actually using in that? And so what we're going to like learn from Meta is what is their definition of creative similarity from their algorithmic standpoint, because what they're saying is that we are consuming and reading all of your ads to decide what is the definition of, or how similar are they to each other. And my understanding, it's more on a spectrum of similarity instead of black and white. This is similar.
And so we want these very different ad types for its testing. Like, we are trying to appease the algorithm here. And then it sounds like the thing they don't want is what we used to do with ad split testing, where it's like, all right, I have one ad that works reasonably well. Now let's take that ad, and the only thing that changes is the headline, is the hook. And we're just going to try that 10 different ways until we get the best one. Okay, that works. Now we're going to try and pair that working hook with different photo. It sounds like they don't want that like real incremental testing.
Yeah, and we're going to find out what happens with variations, right? Like, what is, you know, there's our Meta rep, for example, told us don't do hook testing anymore. And so that changes how many assets we produce significantly. And a lot of people have stopped testing hooks, for example. We're in the mindset that we're actually optimizing for stages of awareness. And then inside of that, what is the transformation that they're looking for? And so if they're looking for a specific component of a health transformation, example like 3, how we talk to a person at different stages of those awareness changes. And then that goes into the types of creative diversity that we were talking about. And so it's meant to be more expansive. And, you know, historically, last year or two, the value of iterations, like true iterations in the sense of like, this template works, I'm going to make more iterations using the same template. That has been, a lot of people have been struggling with that, most brands, I would say, from a performance standpoint, because it doesn't work like it used to. And we call these marginal versus radical concepts. And so the marginal concepts are the iterations. You just keep doing more of what's working and is generally marginal in the sense of like, cool, same script, give it to a different creator. And so we're still going, it's still, you know, marginal in that sense versus like, let's do completely something different in terms of an animation ad or a puppet ad or AI UGC creator or whatever.
And another thing that we have wrestled with this year is the actual implementation of pixels on online stores, you know, as privacy requirements are changing at, you know, a regulatory level. We have to answer that with various compliance features. Has that, you know, and Meta, as far as its Shopify integration goes, really, it kind of sidesteps that process by having an official integration with Shopify that plugs into customer events and, you know, makes life easier. Has that, you know, that attribution, that pixel reporting, you know, that compliance, has that thrown a monkey wrench in the works? Has it changed things? Like, you know, is it another iOS 14, really, I think, is my fear.
No, thank God. So I definitely don't think it's that. I think there's a couple of components. One is that if you are in health and wellness and got categorized in health and wellness, that is a very different series of implementation and considerations that people have to do because they can't optimize for traditional purchase events.
Why?
They're not allowed from a compliance standpoint. And so Meta has decided on a series of criteria to categorize businesses as health and wellness companies and sub buckets of those of that categorization as well. We've had clients who've got hit by that and we couldn't optimize for purchase. We still can't optimize for purchase for some of them. So how someone operates from that perspective is very different from like everyone else. Server-side pixel, there's still a lot of brands who don't have server-side pixel set up or server-side conversions API set up. So I think that's like a no-brainer in terms of setting it up just with Shopify or any of the other solutions that are out there. We use additional solutions for, you know, testing predictive LTV or optimizing for higher event match quality scores in Meta, et cetera. And so that's something that we're always testing. But I think the biggest opportunity that I wasn't expecting from Meta is incremental attribution that...
I've heard about this. Tell me about it. What is it?
Yeah. So incremental attribution, the whole point is that Meta can see all of the purchases that are coming in through Shopify, right? And so they can see, is this a net new conversion of someone who has fired or completed the purchase essentially? And so What we've done, one of our best campaigns across all of our clients, we've switched most of our clients to this, is that we're actually optimizing for incremental attribution. What we're seeing is that we're seeing bigger gaps of like first-time customers to returning customers, which we want. We don't want like the clicks and the purchases to be like 50-50. You know what I mean? For every 100 purchases, we don't want 50 to be new and 50 to be returning of like in attribution platforms, et cetera. We want as many of those customers to be new so that we can optimize for net new customers and make sure we're hitting our targets. And so we have seen a very significant correlation to that campaign. And we've changed, transitioned over a lot of our clients to that. And again, the priority for us and the way that we're measuring that, especially for people listening who are using attribution platforms, we're looking at what is our new visitor rate. So a lot of our clients, the new visitor rate at volume drops to like 60%, 40%. We had one that was like at 25% and that was hit by health and wellness. And so if you're spending a dollar and, you know, 75% of that spend is for people who already went to your website, like it's a problem. And we're not running retargeting. Like that's not retargeting campaigns. Those are supposed to be prospecting campaigns. That's with all the exclusions. And so we started optimizing for this further with additional more aggressive exclusions and for incremental. And we've got back up to 50, 60% new visitor rates, which is what we want while hitting new customer ROAS targets. And so the reason I'm bringing that up is because most people aren't optimizing or looking at, all right, I have all these purchases in platform. How many of them are incremental according to Meta? It is not gospel. It's not like perfect, but it's definitely directionally more correct of why someone shouldn't pick up an attribution platform earlier on in their journey, because it's good enough. It's more than good enough, which is very surprising for me because I've always had challenges with Meta purchase fires and validity of them.
Yeah. If I'm not relying on incremental attribution, you know, what's a good attribution platform you would use today with Shopify?
I mean, for most people, it's going to be something like Triple Whale. I think that's what most people go to. I think at the end of the day, most, even within the attribution platform, like they just look at the dashboard in terms of like, how is my overall business doing instead of like, how are individual campaigns doing? I didn't know that. I spoke to a bunch of Triple Whale users and they're like, oh, I don't actually look at the ads channels breakdown. I just look at what's my new customer ROAS today. So that was interesting. But I don't think it's really necessary until you're maybe at like 100,000 a month in spend or more. Even then, I don't think it's insanely as valuable as it used to be at the initial stages. It's valuable in other ways, but from an attribution and decision-making standpoint, it's, you know, with what I've seen with incremental, it's directionally correct and actually helps with decision-making in a significant way. So Triple Whale, in terms of like smaller businesses, I prefer Northbeam for like businesses above 5 million a year.
Okay. Good to know. Both good platforms. Man, those order change emails suck. They're always like, I ordered the wrong size. I meant to change the shipping address. Oops, I was drunk. Instead of making customers email you that stuff, let them fix it themselves with Cleverific. Cleverific is a self-service portal that lets customers edit their orders without bugging you. That means you get fewer headaches, customers get faster fulfillment, and there's fewer returns overall. Everybody wins. Peter Manning, New York, cut their support tickets by 99% with Cleverific. You want in on that? Get 50% off the pro plan, just $49 a month, exclusively for listeners of the Unofficial Shopify podcast. Go to cleverific.com/unofficial and use promo code KURT50. Done. Problem solved. That's Cleverific. Talk to me about scaling. You've got a scaling ladder, thresholds, you know, ideas. Let's hear it.
I like to start with what is the level of profitability you want to scale at. That's an important decision because some people's threshold is way higher than I expect. They're willing to go negative or they have funding, whatever the case is, or they're specifically mandated to grow at a specific percentage because they have optics that they need to optimize for, right? And so those are very important considerations versus just what is my CPA or like I want a 4x CPA or 4x ROAS. Why? Because I want it. Like that's very different than I need to show 10% month on month growth to my board in order to show that, you know, we're hitting targets and we get our next round of funding or whatever the case is. So I think that's like one part. We do financial modeling based off of what is your growth target in terms of, in order to go from, you're at a million a month, you want to go to 2 million, here are the different scenarios at what happens if you grow 5% a month, 7% a month, 10% a month, et cetera. And based off of that growth and how much new customer revenue is required for that growth, here's how much you have to spend and what the CPA would be like. Obviously, forecasting and doing scenario planning. And so we do that. We also do, depending on what level of access they provide us on the financial statement side and COGS, we can see what the contribution margin will be because fixed expenses are more dependent on things that are outside of our control. But we just want to be able to see net contribution margin. Those variable costs that happen for the actual products don't change that much. And so we're able to predict that. And then based off of that, we decide on what ad channels to go after, what funnels and products to go after, et cetera. And so it's a series of steps that we look at, which is what do you want business-wide? What do you, if especially if the business is very complex and has multiple sales channel from our sales channel, if it's just D2C, what is the goal there? And most businesses don't have P&Ls or reporting on how profitable each channel is. We had a challenge like this for a $25 million business where we had to decide where do we put our next dollar, in Amazon or in Shopify. And so to do that analysis, we would need the profitability numbers. And so, but one feeds into the other, like D2C feeds into Amazon, but Amazon doesn't feed to Shopify. And so those are important decisions. And then once we decide all of these things, we have ongoing pacing and cadence that we look at of like how much are we pacing on a daily basis to new customer revenue, new customer orders, new customer profitability this month. And the commitment we made or the target that we made of how much revenue we want this month, are we on track or off track? And did we overestimate or did we get did we do the calculation right or not? And so those are always humbling because you either find out you're crushing it or you missed a major variable.
Yeah, that's something you want to figure out the hard way later, but certainly it's going to happen. As at some point, you know, I exhaust the market I'm targeting. At that point, what's the playbook? Do I try and find new audiences, different hook, or do I move? I go international, which that seems quite intimidating.
Yeah, I don't believe in exhausting markets. I think like the markets become like less profitable, but it's wild how many businesses are spending over $1 million a month that you and I have never heard of.
Yeah.
And so if you look at their impression counts and how many people they're reaching, for whatever reason, it doesn't reach me, doesn't reach you or a lot of people we know in our circles, but they're reaching so many people out there. So my perspective on like market penetration and like market domination is like changed a lot over the years because I think markets are way bigger. And I think the evolution of what happens in market saturation in the US is there's many different ways to go after segments of the market. And then it's a matter of profitability. But I think if you're going after growth, there's a point where it becomes more expensive to acquire that customer in the US. And then it's way easier and more profitable to get that growth elsewhere. And so I also think that from a market growth standpoint, a lot of the times a limiting factor is how much can you pay for a customer and the amount of and that is directly correlated to your LTV, right? So the more profitable your customers are, the more that you can spend to acquire them. The amount of effort that people spend on acquisition is not 1-to-1 or even like 5-to-1 to on retention and lifecycle marketing usually. It's just not the same effort, resources, time, energy, any of that. And so before, I think like market expansion is cool. I think there's a lot of opportunity. But I think usually what we really push for is what is the one offer ideally that we can get to $1 million to $3 million a month in spend. And depending on kind of revenue targets and recurring, et cetera, how much can we acquire? How many new customers can we acquire on a offer instead of 10 offers at the same time and trying to spend $3 million a month on 10 offers. Out of all the businesses I've analyzed and worked with and seen in the market, very few are doing a lot of spend in our circles in D2C that have like more than 3 offers. It's usually 1-to-3.
Yeah, a little counterintuitive. That surprises me. I want to talk to you about ad creative. Do you have any experience using celebrities in ad creative? I suspect it doesn't perform as well as people think, but I'd have to think it you know, it certainly does well when you have someone recognizable.
Yeah, I think it definitely helps. We had a client who paid Cardi B like $25,000 for a video. Imagine kind of like walking into your house and just sitting down, recording a quick video for 20 seconds and getting paid $25,000. That was like the amount of effort that was put into that video. We did a whitelisting.
It was like a cameo, but it cost $25,000.
Basically, it was absurd. And it crushed. It did incredibly well. I hated the video profoundly, deeply, and it was so bad. But because it was Cardi B, because we had access to our audience, because it was whitelisting, did amazing. And so I think there's a lot to be said about like using those sponsorships and working with celebrities. I just don't have like a lot of experience doing it.
But all right, whitelisting. So with, you know, you got the ad, but then you also got to remarket to that, to Cardi B's audience.
Even better, they had custom audiences of her audience that they could market directly to. So
yeah, that's what the $25,000 paid for.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Like the numbers were incredible. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Just on that topic of whitelisting, I think there's a lot of opportunity with whitelisting and partnership ads right now. I think most brands aren't optimizing for either, in the sense of like getting people to post publicly and then getting permission to use that ad, versus whitelisting, which you can create hundreds of ads that never go on any profiles. You know, it's just an ad. And so I think that's still like very underrated right now, and not enough brands are doing it.
I agree. It's just not something you hear enough about, which, you know, generally indicates like, okay, people just aren't trying it, you know, or maybe unaware that that's an option. So you said, you know, you had this video that performed very well that you profoundly hated. Did you got any favorite ads or maybe formats?
Yeah. So we have like news article styles that like we test for every single client. It looks like a news article in the organic feed. That works very well for many of our clients. We've seen that videos that are above 2 minutes, also, it doesn't have to be like 20 minutes, but a lot of our videos previously were like 60 seconds, and we were optimizing for that. But longer videos do better, especially from an education standpoint, because you have more...
Okay, counterintuitive.
Yeah, yeah. So highly recommend that. The partnership side, and if you're going to be working with UGC people, get three different quotes for them, which is, what is the cost for a video? What is the cost for using your page for an ad, which is whitelisting? And then what is the cost to get a post on your profile? And so most people don't know how to price that. And it's very tricky because, like, you know, does a post on your profile have like, is it worth $10,000 or what is it based off of? No one knows. And so it's all made up. So I would just, really value and love whitelisting and partnership ads. We're seeing crazy lifts there. You know, there were moments that we had success with AI UGC and AI centric creatives, but we're not like really deep in that right now.
My next was going to be AI ad creative. We see it. Sometimes you could spot it. Sometimes it's intentionally obvious. Other times you're like, there's something not quite right about this person. And you're like, I think they're AI, but you don't know. It sounds like avoiding it.
My perspective is that lean into it when it's exaggerated and people know that it's obviously AI, so that you can communicate the pain or the pleasure, the end goal, you know, in an exaggerated way. I think there's value there. I think we have some AI assets that look very accurate and like they're really good. And I think there's an opportunity to do it with like founder ads. So I'm actually rolling out a like workflow where founders don't want to do photo shoots or do ads, you know, but founder ads do perform very well at times. And so there are situations that it can work, but most of our clients, like it's not our core strategy.
Okay. And that makes sense. And that, you know, seems to line up with how other people are creating AI ads. Yeah, you want the ones that are like very obviously AI. Like that seems to be the good use case.
Yeah.
Or I heard someone else say like, oh, you know, we had an ad, but like one part of the ad needed to be replaced. And so they just used AI to just like fix that one section. And then when it's part of a larger real thing, it's much less obvious or jarring. On your AdPros website, so you do Meta ads and Google ads, and you also do Taboola. I've seen, you know, like ad by Taboola for years. I've never actually bothered to figure out what it is. What the heck is Taboola?
Yeah, so Taboola is, so when you go to a blog and at the bottom of a blog, there's like recommended articles, that is Taboola. So someone already has intent to read and they're about to click the next thing that they're about to read. And so that is a Taboola ad.
And are they running like a, so it's specific to, you know, publishers?
Yes, it's based off of like limited publishers based off of the kind of the platform that you're using. So Taboola is one, Outbrain is another, there's a bunch of them. And so based off of the relationships they have, there's some overlap, but the goal is that you have specific publishers you want to go after, or specific publishers may perform better for you. And you can control devices in terms of mobile and desktop. And so there's a lot of flexibility in terms of what you can do and what you show someone generally within the limits of compliance. But I think it's a phenomenal platform. I think there's a lot of opportunity for scale for D2C brands, but it's very difficult to crack. You know, we've had the privilege to crack it a few times, but I think the goal of those creatives is that if you have difficult, like mass market, difficult to understand or unique mechanisms that you're trying to communicate to someone, Taboola or native ads generally are really good to educate them through listicles in terms of like five reasons why and reasons why, that kind of stuff, as well as stories.
Yeah, listicles, advertorials, I think that's probably one of the biggest missed opportunities for online stores in terms of advertising. Just when we have had clients use them, they seem to work really well. You know, there's that idea that like no one reads. I don't think it's true, right? Like they skim until you get them interested and then they'll read. And so for, you know, that type of ad really separates the wheat from the chaff. You know, the person who was not going to buy is also not going to read it.
Right.
The person who reads it becomes that much more likely to buy.
Yeah. And what's your definition of reading, right? Because like if you're skimming, you still are consuming. It's just more so comprehension. Like what are they remembering? And so that's where the, you know, the time on site you can see, and you can see user journeys of like what they're reading and where they stop and what they scroll past, all of that. I think there's a lot to be said there. And one of our clients, they mass developed a bunch of landing pages. We tested like seven of them, and five of them are hitting or exceeding targets by 50% to 100% based off of their business as usual campaigns, because they're all listicles and advertorials. So older demographic, but did incredibly well.
What's your spiciest take on Meta ads? You're like, man, this is the thing I wish they would quit doing. They would change. This is where everybody else is wrong.
Right now, what I'm thinking a lot about is like people went from underproducing creatives to now with Andromeda are overproducing like crazy. Like it's so wild. It's like if we're creative agencies only, like we do creative, but we're not a traditional like creative agency. I think it's awesome for retainers because people want more creatives. But I think that is by far the most expensive and one of the worst use of cash right now, because what happens is that you are there's a cost per asset, cost per concept, right? For a lot of brands, it's $250 to $500 for one concept, creative.
It's expensive.
It's expensive. I mean, it depends on the size of your business, whatever, but it's still expensive. And then based off of that, you have to test it. And so now there's ad budget that goes beyond that. And so there are media buyers that the way they structure it is that if it doesn't get spent, it's not a good ad. So the issue is that now you spent $500 on a creative and it never got spent. And so you just threw away 500 times number of concepts that never got spent. Or the other thing is that now you have a bunch of creatives that you created, and because you tested so much at the same time, you don't have enough dollars to test so that you can break through with the creatives that actually deserve your spend. And so it's way better to find like the Goldilocks range of how much creative should I test at different revenue levels or spend levels, as well as account status. And that way is way easier. We put together a calculator to do exactly that. And that way you can see, okay, right now I can only test seven concepts a week. If I produce 14, I'm burning money.
That's, yeah. And you're right. I mean, that is a lot of what I've heard, you know, since that Andromeda update, is people just like desperate for quantity of content and like get really excited about like, oh, I get 150 pieces of content. Holy crap, what do you do with it?
Yeah. And a lot of the times it's just like, I'm just going to put it in an ad set and see what works. It's like, that's fine. But the flip-flopping that happens from, again, the signal component that we're talking about, some days the signal is good on a couple of ads, but then it doesn't have enough time to really optimize and break through and keep breaking through. It flip-flops. And so it restarts that process. And so I think that is one of the things as I'm going through sales calls and audits and all this stuff, I'm like, everyone just went from like not producing enough to like going insane.
And certainly AI is not helping that.
I agree.
If someone's listening and they're thinking like, wow, this approach is so rigorous in its thinking, and they manage their own ads before they go out and spend the money on an agency retainer, what's one thing they could do on their own in their own ad campaigns to add like the Nihal level of rigor to their ad platform?
I don't think every business needs a Nihal level of rigor. I have been humbled enough times to know that if your system is working, don't break it. Right. So there's a lot of ways to add your next million a month in revenue. If your method is working, great. Do more of that. Right. Because like, doesn't matter what I think. If it's not, then I think it starts going down the process of like, how do I make sense of the chaos? That's more so my approach, which is if I don't understand the variables, if I don't know what the levers are, if I don't know where to like how to make decisions or where to make decisions or where to coach my team, that's where the starting point comes in. And the most important thing from my perspective, where I look at, where I always start, is profitability of what happens on business-wide and new customer. If you do not have a dashboard on tracking daily profitability on new customer acquisition of your volume, of how many orders you're getting, what your net contribution margin is in terms of just like, what is your revenue minus your COGS and delivery payment processing minus your ad spend on a daily basis. If you just start tracking that, it's like looking at your bank account every day, you get exposed and now you start asking higher quality questions. So it's higher quality clues that you're looking for. And so I've done this for many businesses over and over again. And the first thing that happens is like, you get exposed and you're like overwhelmed and sometimes freak out of like, I didn't know my numbers were that bad or that good. Usually it's bad. And then they're like, okay, now I can kind of see the matrix. Now let me figure out what do I do next? Because before, no one knew. They were just looking at what does Meta say what my CPA is today? It's not real. That's not your business-wide new customer CPA. That's just your Meta CPA or that's just your Google CPA. And so the immediate thing that you can do, even if you track it manually, because you don't need, you know, Supermetrics or all these connectors, you don't need any of that. In the beginning, whether it's you or someone on your team on a daily basis at the start of every day, just put in what is my new customer profitability metrics. You can do it with total customers too, but minimum of new customers, how much did I spend? How many new customer orders did I get? How much new customer revenue did I get based off of what people bought? What do I think the margin or the COGS are and the margin on that? And then you can say, did I do better or worse than yesterday? That is like, will be life-changing as a starting point.
That is, you know, that makes it so accessible and practical. I love that advice. And the, you know, hey, you check your bank account every day. You probably do. You maybe should. That, like hearing that, like, oh, you know, it's like the things you check daily are, you know, what you get good at and you start to get a real sense of.
Yeah. Do you care enough about new customer acquisition? That is the real question underneath that, you know, because again, it's not based off of what you care about. You're like, what you care about shows up based off of your actions, not your thoughts or your you know, words or anything like that. I think it is directly correlated to your actions because I have this in different parts of my life where I'm like, I really value that, but my actions aren't aligned sometimes. And so, and I see that when I'm coming in and auditing different businesses where I'm looking at this, new customers are so valuable to me. It's like, cool, show me a dashboard. Don't have one. And so how are you deciding how many creatives to test? How much do you want to spend? What is your new customer like goal or growth rate? What do you want? Can't answer those questions. So it's like, it's not because you don't value it. It's you don't know how to value it based off of actions. And so that's the really hard part. And that's just part of, you know, personal development as a leader, as a growth marketer, and it's ongoing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. I need a dashboard with some KPIs in it that I can check daily. I like these ideas. Nihal, I'm willing to bet you have resources for us. Now, where can we go learn more about you?
Yeah. So if you have show notes, I'll send you links so that you can add those. The easiest way to get a hold of me is on Instagram and LinkedIn. And so just Nihal Kazim and mention Kurt, and I'll send you a couple of resources on specifically how much you should be testing. That is a very important part. We have a calculator for that. So it relieves a lot of stress and anxiety of like, what should I do? What should I tell my team? Every like creative teams and growth teams overall just want to know how much creative should I test and how much should I launch? And so I have a solution on that. So I'll send that over. And then second is that when you're looking at ad creatives, when it comes to creative diversity, there's not really a formula out there. And so I created one when it comes to what happens from a creative ad type and creative type and ad types, so that you can have 34 different ideas so that you can share it with your team and say, how many of these have we actually tested? Because we're all very used to comfort naturally, which is we keep doing type of creatives that have worked historically, but that is the opposite of diverse. It's similar. And so here's a bunch of ideas so that you can get greater diversity.
Beautiful. Yeah, we'll include that stuff
awesome.
In the show notes. Nehal Kazim, AdPros, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, before you go, I was hoping you would check out our new app, Promo Party Pro. It is what I want to be the single best, easiest way to run a free gift with purchase promo on Shopify. We just put it live in the App Store. We've got less than 50 users. We want your feedback. So if you need to run a free gift with purchase promo in the near future, install it, try it. There's a live chat. I check that all the time. And so if you have any issues at all, you know, or any suggestions on how we can make it even easier to use, let us know. We're happy to help. If you want to try it, search Promo Party in the App Store. Promo Party Pro is the app. Give it a shot. It's got a free trial. Thanks.